Hey, Orthopreneurs, it's Dr. Glenn Krieger here, and let me tell you, the Orthopreneurs 2024 Summit, which is going to be on a Royal Caribbean ship, has taken off. I don't mean literally, but we actually booked an entire ship just for us. We started selling it already, and believe it or not, it's selling out fast. People want to come by themselves. People want to bring their team. People want to bring their families. Remember, there's a kids club there, and there's also an adult-only pool. So you can watch the presentations streaming throughout the whole ship. Imagine sitting in the pool with a drink in your hand, watching someone speak on tips and tricks to help your practice get better while you're sitting knee-deep in a pool with a drink in your hand. Sounds pretty cool, right? Well, you've come to know the kind of meetings we put together, and this one's going to be even more exceptional and even more affordable. Go to opsummit2024.com to sign up now.
Good news for orthodontists, the rule in nearly every state is you have to have graduated from a residency program and a CODA recognized specialty to advertise as an orthodontic specialist. So everybody who's graduated from an orthodontic residency program can do that. The reason I always mention this and include this is because, you know, a GP can advertise that they're doing orthodontic treatment. They cannot advertise that they're an orthodontist or imply that they're a specialist in orthodontics.
This is the Orthopreneur Show with Glenn Krieger, talking about the things you never learned in school, like marketing, management, and leadership.
Hello there, Orthopreneurs, and welcome to another episode of your Orthopreneurs Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Glenn Krieger. And today we've got a guitar playing, dirt track, stock car racing attorney. Please put your hands together and welcome Trey Lawrence.
That is correct. Yep. Great to be here.
Yeah. Good to have you. And we'll get a little more into the dirt track, stock car racing. I mean, I'm not going to put down playing instruments. That's amazing. I Lord knows I have no musical talent whatsoever. So I'm very jealous. I've tried. But if you don't mind, like I always start, can you take 60, 90 seconds and tell everybody a little bit about yourself and how you kind of ended up where you are now?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you said, Vice President, General Counsel for the AAO, head the AAO's legal and advocacy, our government relations or lobbying programs. So what got me to that point, St. Louis native for most of my life, grew up there, detoured for college. To College of Missouri State, got a master's degree at Harvard, and loved Boston, favorite city other than my hometown in the U.S., and then went back to law school at Washington University in St. Louis. I graduated in 2001. I spent 18 years at a big law firm that's based out of St. Louis and has offices in a number of other cities also, in commercial litigation, product liability, class actions, those kind of things. And so spent the key point, all of that, spent a lot of time in the courtroom. And so then after 18 years of that, came to the AAO and associate general counsel and then my current position. And that courtroom piece, I think a lot of the topics we're going to talk about today, that courtroom piece, having actually been in the courtroom and see the way that legal issues play out with juries and judges and knowing the way that juries think and the psychological factors, some of that, that's really the background that I try to bring when I talk to orthodontists and others in the dental community about legal issues. I really try to bring that piece of it because knowing the reality of if you get sued, this is what that world looks like and how it plays out, I think is really useful to them. And that's the piece from my former life I try to bring over into my current role.
Well, I appreciate that. And I'm wondering how many people went straight from Missouri State to Harvard. Like that's educationally speaking, I'm not trying to disparage Missouri State in any way
whatsoever. Oh, no.
But that is an interesting leap right there. Was that culture? I just have to ask real quick. Was there a real big culture shock when you went from that smaller school to Harvard?
Oh, absolutely. In every way. I mean, those two settings are about as on the opposite ends of the spectrum in as many ways as you. I mean, educationally, culturally. Yeah, it was a lot of culture adjustment in a lot of ways, but loved it. Had a great, yeah. And to answer your original question there, how many people have made that jump? I don't know for sure. It's got to be, you know, two hands at most.
At least one. We know that.
Right, right.
And before we get too deep into things, if you don't mind taking just 10 seconds, how did I, you see, folks, I get to learn a little bit about my guests before we actually go on the air. And I did learn there was a time where this Harvard trained guy who ended up becoming an attorney actually raced stock car dirt track cars. How did that happen?
Yeah. So, and while I was a lawyer too, which is the real interesting wrinkle, because again, to your question of how many people did this and this, I'm pretty sure the number of lawyers in the U.S. that are currently, you know, while they're a lawyer racing dirt track stockers, got to be.
Who came from Missouri State to Harvard.
Absolutely. No, it's a lot of rare factors coming together there in that equation. No, I had a friend that had a Pepsi distributorship that serviced one of the, we have three or four dirt track, stock car tracks in the St. Louis area. His Pepsi distributorship served one of them. He said, "Hey, you got to come watch this." I went, I was hooked. Just the roar of the engines and the smell, you know, just everything about the racetrack experience was amazing. And went three or four times. And then after watching that for a little while, I was sitting there in the stands thinking, you know what, I'm going to be 85 or 90 someday sitting in a nursing home thinking, boy, I wish I had given that a shot while I was able to. And so jumped in and did it for two seasons and it was phenomenal. There are not many hobbies where if you go home at the end of the night just saying, hey, I'm pretty happy I'm alive, then you count that as a win, but that was one of them. But no, it was phenomenal.
That's awesome. It's a great story. So let's jump right into legal stuff. And the first question, which you and I have never even discussed earlier, was as vice president and general counsel for the AAO, what resources, if any, are available to the standard? And again, I'm going to make a differentiation here, an orthodontist versus an AAO orthodontist. I assume to be able to avail yourself of any legal benefits, you have to be an AAO member, obviously, right?
Right.
But if you're an AAO member, what legal, in a broad sense, are available to any orthodontist who's an AAO member if they need it?
Yeah, absolutely. There are a whole bunch of them. And I think some of our members are very familiar with them and some of them are not at all. So I'd love getting the opportunity to get the word out about them. But we have, if you go to the AAO member website, there are articles on a number of, you know, there's a HIPAA article, an article about dismissing patients mid-treatment, just all of those kind of subject areas. There are articles about all of those things. There are lots of forms, you know, patient contracts, informed consents, the waiver. If you have a patient, you need to give them a refund. You know, you're going to end treatment and give them a refund. You don't want them to sue you later. And you want them to sign a waiver. That all of those kind of forms are up on the AAO member website under the legal resources section. And then also we have, if members look at all of that and they say, I still have a question, you know, and I didn't see the answer there. There is a form on the website there that you can fill in your contact information, type out your question that comes to us in the legal department. And one of us in the legal department will get back to you either with some additional resources. Sometimes we'll pull from outside sources or the ADA or other legal resources on the web and we can get you those resources or otherwise give you information. The one limitation, we can't give legal advice to members. So we couldn't represent you if you were being sued, but we can give you a lot of information about a lot of the most common questions. So all of that is up there on the AAO member website under the legal resources tab.
Fantastic. Thank you. You know, it's funny because for those listening who don't know that I run the Orthopreneurs Facebook group, we have about 6,500 orthodontists on there. You know, it's funny. Someone says, anybody have a form of X? Does anybody have a form for this? And oftentimes there's some great people who give stuff, but you can also go to the AAO website and download a lot of these forms that you're asking for if you're an AAO member. And again, I full disclosure, I do not have a financial interest in the AAO. I just want to say that out loud because I can. So let's start with your legal issue inventory. You want to talk a little bit about that? Because I think that's a good place to start. And we're going to get into the real topics that I know that there's some great stuff out there about social media and ortho, about patient records and social media, about certain legal advice issues that we're going to hit through, stuff that you definitely want to hear what we're about to cover, because it's no longer your buddy's best friend who's an orthodontist who heard someone say that this is the truth. You're going to hear it straight from general counsel from the AAO. So you can take that one to the bank or to the court if you wish. So what is the legal issue inventory?
A common reaction to practice, especially if I do a presentation where I address a number of the topics that we're going to talk about today, you know, kind of give them the laundry list of legal issues that they need to know about. A frequent reaction to that is, oh, just like overwhelmed. They're just overwhelmed with, there just seems like there's so much stuff out there. And it's really a matter, we don't know what we don't know. We want to be in compliance with the law. I think there's very few practices that just want to willingly be breaking the law. But a lot of practices just don't even know where to start. on tackling all of this, and especially the what do we not even know that we don't know. So what I've tried to do is give practices a systematic way to work through those issues. And that's what I call my legal issue inventory. But it is a systematic process. And basically the way it works is you as a team at your practice, you commit, you know, one of your huddles or one of your normal meetings, you commit, you say, okay, for the next 3 months or the next month, however long, usually the longer the better, but 3 months is a good starting place. For the next 3 months, we're just going to keep a list of every problem situation that we run into that potentially has some legal aspect to it. So whether that's you're on social media and you read something and you say, oh, I didn't know that it was even an issue, you write that down. Or you have a problem interaction with a patient that presents a new situation. And usually after 3 or 6 months of doing that, then you start to get a clear idea. What are the legal issues we most frequently interact with? And then that list becomes your priority list of, okay, these are the legal issues we need to find out the answer to. So after you've compiled that list for your 3 or 6 months, you turn that into your checklist, and then you start to find out the answers to those questions. And that may be, you know, that may very well be to get on the AO website, like we just talked about, or some other sources on the internet. It might be, the question might be more specific and you need to talk to a lawyer, especially if it's something specific to your state. But that at least gives you a framework of what are the issues that we need to tackle, because these are the issues we're running into in practice. And then let's work through those. And then at the end of the 6 months, you've got that set. And then I really think, you know, as a practice thing, continue to commit to that. Okay, 6 months is a good starting point, but let's keep that running list. And then every 6 months, let's say, let's come back to it and revisit it. And are there some new issues that came up that we think those are also priorities? Let's find out the answer to those also.
Nice. And, you know, I, full disclosure, again, I'm the son of an attorney. I'm the nephew of an attorney. I'm the best friend to two attorneys. Attorneys are like the number one thing in my family, it seems, over the last, I'm the nephew twice over of two attorneys. So, you know, the interesting thing I've always learned over the years is that what you think is the answer, which may seem perfectly commonsensical, if such a word exists, is not necessarily what legal sense is. And so I'm going to go off the reservation a little bit here, because you and I covered a couple of things. And I figure a guy like you, a dirt track stock car racer, will be able to solve this because your reflexes are good. One of the things that we talk a lot about online is employment termination, right? It popped up in my head, and feel free to sort of take the fifth if you want to, even though it's not your right to take the fifth here. When I have a protected class of individual, right? Or someone who's perceived to be protected class. I know it's a silly question or state it that way, but there are people out there that we're scared of firing, right? Now there's two types of, I've found two kinds of orthodontists. There's the first kind who fires at will all the time, right? It's like, Susie didn't listen to me, she's fired. You know, it's almost like back in the day with The Apprentice, right? You're fired, you're fired, you're fired. And there's really no policy or procedure that's followed in any way. You know, Trey shows up late to work one day, doctor pulls Trey aside. Hey, Trey, you know, you can't be showing up late to work. No write-up is done. They come up late a second time. Trey, I warned you last week, I got to let you go, right? And that's the first type. The second type is the one who goes the other direction. Trey, you're 2 minutes late. This is going to be a formal write-up today. And I need to write this up. I need you to sign this to acknowledge that you've seen it. If it happens two more times, you're going to be let go. It happens two more times, they do a formal write-up. And even there, if it's a protected class of individual, there's a great fear, a great concern that this pregnant woman, or again, any of the classes, which I'd love for you to explain, if you don't mind, where do people find protection in, of course, race, religion, age, pregnancy. I don't know what you refer to that as. But first of all, I guess my question is this ridiculously long question. Number one, what are the protected classes that employees fall under?
Yeah, so that's Title VII. So that's race, gender, religion, national origin, and there are a couple of other categories too. I mean, and I think going to your bigger question there, sometimes I think it's easier for employers to fixate on certain of the protected classes, but really when you break it down, nearly everybody falls into a protected class because, you know, if the employee that you're terminating is older, then they could claim they're being fired because they're too old. If they're younger, they could be claimed that they're being fired because they're too young. Same thing with gender. Oh, they only want, you know, they only want women working as receptionists, or, oh, they don't like women. So really almost everybody, you absolutely have to think through the lens of the protected classes, because almost 99% of employees fall into some protected class. So to your point, then, the challenge is going to be at-will employment. You are absolutely legally entitled to terminate any employee at any time for any reason or for no reason at all. That's at-will employment. The rule is essentially the same in every state in the country.
So just pausing for a second.
Yeah.
Every state in the country has at-will employment where I can fire somebody for any reason at any time.
Oh, yeah. The only exception to that would be if somebody is on a written contract. So if you have an associate that's right. got a 5-year contract, that kind of thing, then that's
with take termination credits. Notice of 60 or 30 or 90 days, whatever it might be. But however, there is no law that stipulates how someone can feel about being fired.
Absolutely.
And is that where the problem starts?
That is absolutely where the problem starts, is because disgruntled former employees, they may not even know it themselves, but certainly they're just mad. So they go talk to a lawyer, and a plaintiff's attorney that represents terminated employees is going to try to fit them into one of the protected classes and then portray the termination as having been for a discriminatory reason in violation of one of those protected classes, instead of for a legitimate reason or no reason at all. They're going to try to cram it in to one of those. And so the key to the whole defense there is thinking through that lens that every employee that is terminated for a legitimate reason is going to claim it was for an illegitimate reason. What is the evidentiary record that I'm going to need to prove to a judge or jury or the Department of Labor, the EEOC, a governmental agency that's reviewing it? What is the evidentiary record I'm going to need to prove to them that I did not terminate them for the alleged illegitimate reason, that I terminated them for a legitimate reason?
So what is the legal hoop I need to jump through? And I let me just preface that by saying, for instance, Trey shows up late to work. I say, Trey, here's a written form that says you've been late and being disciplined. The next time he shows up, I fire him. I have a record that Trey was delinquent. He was late. He was late the second time. But I didn't threaten in the letter that if it happens again, you're going to be fired, right? And so where do I, you know, we've got the, you know, beyond a shadow of it, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt is one type of legal level that we read, right? Preponderance of evidence is another in developing civil versus criminal. But in this forum, I know the go-to answer for the general counsel of the AAO is going to be, you can never have enough, right? That's going to be the go-to answer. But that's the high watermark. What's the low watermark here? And I know it's a very difficult question for anybody in the legal field to answer, but I kind of think you understand where I'm coming from.
I'll hedge you a little bit here, but I'll just say the more that you have that exists prior to the termination, an employment policy that addressed the situation that existed prior to the termination, or a warning letter, something else in writing where you've given the employee that, none of that is a legal requirement, but the more of that you have, the more likely you're going to be to convince the jury that your version of the story is correct and not the employee's version that says that they were terminated because they were a protected class.
So we tend to get very scared, right? For those of us who care a lot about, you know, your life and financially, we tend to get scared a little bit. And I don't mean scared, but you get my point. So for instance, can you let someone go because a disability prevents them, a disability received after they've been hired prevents them from doing their job effectively or keeps them from work. So quick example. And again, I'm father of three, strong supporter of women's rights. But this is going to come across the wrong way. You've got a pregnant woman who's your assistant. She's pregnant and she has morning sickness. And you find out now she's missing, you know, 3 days of the 4 days work week. She's not in. She's sick. And it goes on for 1 week. It goes on for 2 weeks. It goes on for 4 weeks. Now, you're not talking to a guy who would ever, I would never, ever, you know, terminate a pregnant woman. I want to be crystal clear here. But it sort of lends itself to an example of, you know, what are your legal rights of the question? If she's not able to perform her duties because she's that, or let's just say, you know, someone's diagnosed with some sort of illness, HIV, for instance, is an example. I don't know if it still falls under disability protection or if that's changed, but I remember in the 90s, that was a big deal. Someone has a sickness, an illness, whatever it might be, and keeps them from coming to work on a regular basis. Does one have the right to terminate them? Hello there, orthopreneurs. Sign up for the Orthopreneurs 24 Summit now. We took over an entire ship just for us. And here's the thing. It's selling out so fast right now that the room types are selling out. So if there's a particular type of cabin you want, you better get on to opsummit2024.com right now and sign up. And why are people signing up? Because of three reasons. Number one, it's a boat, which means you can bring your team, your family. Yes, there's a kids club. And yes, there's an adults only pool. Number two, the lineup I have is going to be spectacular. These are not people you're going to see on any other stage anywhere. I dug deep to find the best to help you live your best, most profitable, most productive, personal, and practice lives. And they're going to blow you away. And number three, the type of cabin you want is limited. This is not a hotel where most of the rooms are the same. If you want one with a balcony, they're selling out. You want an inside room to save money, they're selling out. So go to opsummit2024.com right now, sign up for a cruise September 18th to 22nd, and you will have the best CE time of your life. And now, back to the podcast.
So that is that's probably of all the employment law issues, you know, that are challenging, that's right at the heart of the
most. I'm sorry, Trey.
No. Absolutely. But I, you know, in general, the standard for any of those analyses that has to do with the disability is going to be, is there a reasonable accommodation that you can make?
Right.
Reasonable accommodation means that an employer does not have to go to the ends of the earth. They have to do anything possible, no matter how prohibitively expensive it is, or, you know, just completely. Right. Change the essential nature of the job to accommodate, but is there a reasonable accommodation? Now, anytime we lawyers use the word reasonable, that's code for, we don't know exactly how to write the law at that point. So we're going to throw it over to a jury. And that is your preponderance of the evidence standard. So, okay. Even as squishy as that term is, that still gives you at least somewhat of a lens to think through in those kind of situations. So like your example with the morning sickness and the pregnant employee, if it's something that's going to last for a limited term, are there other jobs, you know, can you do some schedule rearranging that maybe accounts for her situation, gets her through that time, and you don't have to let her go? I mean, again, that's going to be a very individualized determination based on the practice, how many other staff they have, what are the economic repercussions of that kind of rearranging? You know, what is a reasonable accommodation for a larger practice that has more staff at hand that they can move around? Might not be, you know, that might be past a reasonable accommodation for a smaller practice that only has a few key staff. But that's always a lens to think through. Is there something we can reasonably do that's not prohibitively expensive, doesn't just permanently change the nature of this job assignment, that can account for this situation and let us keep this person in our employment?
Right. And it's, again, I would, like I said, I would never, ever let go of a pregnant one just because of my caring for the human being behind there. But it's such an easy example to pull because it's so commonplace and we deal with it. If someone is pregnant and gives birth, maternity, states, I'm sure states have some sort of laws on maternity. And again, you want to give moms and I assume dads paternity leave as well. You want to sort of work within the boundaries of not only what legal is there, but what they need as well. Is there a time at which it's so long that you can simply say, I can't do this? You want 8 months maternity. I can't give you 8 months maternity. I assume that's all written up in your office manual and policy related to, right? As long as, I think the theme here is, as long as you've got it in writing beforehand and everybody's agreed to it, then it's an easy conversation. But what if you didn't create a good office policy manual? And hopefully everybody after this goes and creates one. There's been some great podcasts on that we've had talks with Ben Derrickson about, that we've had with Cedar, some great conversations with them about creating an office. But what if you don't have one right now, which is some people listening, and your employee says, you know, I just had a child. I want to spend the next 6 months with him at home. And they're one of three clinical assistants and you can't let them be gone for 6 months. Do you have rights there?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the default is going to be, what is your state law? If you don't have a policy that's set ahead of time, and even if you do have a written policy, obviously you can't have it. Just because you have a personnel manual doesn't mean, you know, if the state requirement is 12 weeks, you can't make it 8 just because you have the personnel manual. You've got to make sure whatever your personnel policy is in compliance with the state law. But I would say if you don't have the manual ahead of time, then whatever the state law is, and those vary pretty widely. I mean, there are some states that are incredibly generous on that side, and there's some states that are pretty restrictive. But definitely find out what your state law is, and I think that's the default. If you've got the employee that claims they need more than that, you know, it's in excess of the state law, then I would say you're perfectly entitled to stick to what the law is in your state.
And as we move on from this topic, the last question I'll ask, which I think isn't that complicated. At the bottom line is there is no set standard of when I can dismiss somebody from my practice. It's at will. I can let anybody go at any time for any reason. I just need to be mindful of, is there potentially in their mind grounds for wrongful termination? And if so, how do I plan on protecting myself in a court of law from the evidentiary record that's in front of me? And again, there shouldn't be any excuse, I suspect, from what you're saying about why somebody who's not performing their job and been informed about it appropriately shouldn't be let go.
No, absolutely. It's just making sure that you're fully able to exercise those legal rights when you need to. The more you do ahead of time with the personal manual and having your employees review and sign acknowledging that they reviewed and all those kind of things, those are the steps you do ahead of time to help. And then I'll throw one other bonus point in there too. This comes from being in the courtroom and seeing the way these things play out. The most damning evidence, I think, that comes in nearly every one of those cases are the off-color jokes and, you know, inappropriate pictures and things like that that should not be a part of an office culture, but sometimes slide in. And I know people feel like, you know, the soup Nazi trying to enforce some of that stuff, like, oh, we don't want to let people have fun. But I'm just telling you, every case that I've ever was involved in firsthand, the off-color jokes and those kind of things, that's the most damning evidence in those cases. And so that is a great reason why you should police all that, because even if you do everything 100% legitimately as far as personnel manual, or have employees review it, you give them a formal write-up, all of that, if you have a culture where you let some of that stuff go unpoliced, then every example of that is going to come in the lawsuit and is going to cloud what otherwise should be a pretty sound evidentiary foundation for your case.
Great point. Thank you for that. Let's talk social media. So you're going into one of any number of great online Facebook groups, and somebody says, hey, I got this case. I don't know what to do with it. Take a look at these records and tell me what you think. Don't worry, I've covered their eyes and I've gotten rid of all the names on it. So you can't tell from looking at it who it is, not their face, not their eyes, not their name, not any identifiers. Is that okay?
I would say it's a start. I don't think we're there all the way yet.
Because just to add, most, I can speak for only orthopreneurs. If anybody put a case on with clearly if there's eyes, that's a problem. Clearly, if their name is on it, that's a problem. And I always try to police that the best I can. I'm human. If you've taken out all the identifiers to recognize who this human being is, but that's a start, what else do I need to do?
So this is a really interesting, you're hitting on all the hot buttons here.
When you run a group, you hear them all.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure.
And by the way, what's my liability afterwards? I'd love to hear you talk about my liability as the administrator of the group.
Yeah. Where the wrinkle comes in with all of this, there is a line of case law. I say we're just on the front end of it developing, but the common understanding is, well, if you've got the picture, like the photos, the before and after photos of the teeth, if you black the rest of the face out, that we're good on HIPAA. But there is a line of case law that I think is just starting to develop. There was one case, and I believe it was in Florida. It was a limited jurisdiction case, but I think it was the first warning of this, where a court held that even with the rest of the face blacked out, the teeth are so personally identifying that can still be a HIPAA violation if you don't have the patient's authorization and you're showing it to people that aren't authorized to see that information, you know, not another treating doctor. So that case is not binding all across the U.S., but I know the direction of courts has been nearly every HIPAA case that comes along, courts tend to rule on the side of the patients. So I think they're going to expand in this. And the court had some sound rationale in that case. Court said, you know, if there's an accident or a fire or something like that, what is it that they use to identify the deceased person? It's their teeth. It's their records.
It put me in that courtroom as an expert witness. And I'll say to them very clearly, yes, they use the teeth, but they also use fingerprints, and fingerprints are not readily identifiable. So just because we use it for identification purposes, counsel, does not necessarily mean it stands the muster, you know, passes muster for court. But you understand where I'm coming with that. I would argue that I could show you two people's faces with their teeth and then do a lineup of four people, and 100 people would not recognize which one is those four. I mean, it just, but I get it. It's case law. And as we said before, sometimes it's nonsensical, and but it's the law, as Judge Walker used to say.
No, absolutely. Trey sitting here personally completely agrees with you. I would absolutely be on your, you know, would make your argument as well. But the law doesn't always line up with common sense. And I think this is one of those areas, especially, you know, a lot of this being plaintiff driven and plaintiff attorney driven, and HIPAA is just a hotbed of litigation right now. I'm just afraid things are going to tend in that direction more. So I'm not telling people prohibitively they can't do it without a release from the patient at this point in time, but I at least want to get orthodontists conscious of this issue and thinking that this may be, you know, something that they need to think through in the future.
So as of right now, as of this second, it's not case law, it's not statute across the country to where if you show someone's blacked out eyes and face and de-identify everything, that it's a problem. But foreseeably in the future, it could become a problem. And that's as of May, you know, April, May, 2023. We'll talk again in April, May of 2024 and see if it's changed. But to your point, talk about the release itself. Now, I was once taught years and years ago that with my intake form, after the medical history, there was just one paragraph that basically said, I allow the use, sharing, whatever it was, sharing of the images and any records of mine de-identified as part of educational and social media platform or something along those lines. Is that enough? Or do I need to have something really specific and really deep? Or once they said, no, you can use my pictures and likeness for social media and educational purposes, it, you know, does that stand, you know, pass muster again in court? Or do I need something, a specific photographic release that has to be a separate sheet of paper?
Technically, legally, yeah, that absolutely should be enough. But again, having been in the courtroom and having seen these arguments, I know perpetually every consumer, every patient, and this is not just, you know, orthodontics or even the dental practice, this is just consumers generally, the number one defense, they if there's something that has their signature on it, they don't like what it says, the defense is always going to be, well, I didn't know what I was signing.
Right.
And I've seen judges that are incredibly sympathetic to that. So I would say the more you can do to knowing that that's going to be what the patient who doesn't like that is going to argue, the more you can do to refute that. So certainly having just a freestanding photo release is probably the best practice. But if you're going to include that language in a, you know, patient contract or some other intake document, I would say at the least, make that one of those things that you get the patient to separately initial that as you walk them through that, some bold, you know, maybe larger font, all of those kind of things that say, no, I did bring this to this patient's attention. The more of that you have, the better.
So what about other, that's, we just talked social media groups, right? Orthodontic groups. But what about the patient? Trey brings in his daughter for, and by the way, I know nothing about Trey's family, but Trey brings in his daughter for orthodontic care. We get started and then I say, hey, Trey, let's get a picture of you and your daughter here in front of the Krieger Orthodontics wall. And we take a picture, we post it on social media. I assume that you need to have a release for that as well, even though they've been told we're going to post this on our page. Now, could it be made clear that I was using a camera? I told you this is going to go on our Facebook. You posed for the photo knowing it was going to go on Facebook, because why would I have a camera? What do I store the photos in my camera so that I can just look at them later? Like, is there a point at which the common sense nature, and I know we've said that word many times, the common sense nature of what we're doing is sort of tacit permission? You know, I know that if a mother, for instance, took a picture of her kid with her new braces and posted on social media, there's clearly no problem with that, which would be ideal is that, as Chris Feldman, my friend, always says, have parents take photos and put them on their social media and tag you, which is a nice way to go. But can I argue and say they knew I was taking a photo of them for social media? How can they argue this?
No, in some situations, that kind of a common sense argument would prevail. But those are the situations where the law is not specific about this. With HIPAA is specific on this one. And as much as that all makes sense intuitively, HIPAA is very specific on what you need to get. And just to back that up, not just HIPAA, but the way that HHS has implemented HIPAA, is incredibly specific. And so that very specific law says, even if all that is the case, we're going to insist on the letter of the law, which is that you need to get a signed release from the patient. There need to be certain elements in that release, and there are resources available on HIPAA's HHS's HIPAA page that say what the elements are that need to be in the release. And to underscore all of that, HHS has dinged two or three dental practices over the last couple of years on HIPAA photo related issues, you know, where they fined practices $25,000 or $50,000 for not complying with the strict letter of the law in this area.
And on that note, again, there's all these wives' tales, folk tales, right, about what goes on. You know, you're liable for, I forget the number, each violation is $25,000, but right. And you have 2,000 patients out there you've taken photos of. So you're looking at 2,000 times 25,000, and, right. You know, you're going to be into the tune of $50 million or whatever the number might be. Is that just kind of silliness? Is it typically, hey, we're dinging you on this. Yeah, we're going to hit you for $25,000 or $50,000, and that's a lot of money. But we're not going to hit you with $1 million fine or $2 million fine or $5 million. Have you ever seen that where they hit somebody with millions of dollars? And number two, typically that's going to be covered by your malpractice carrier, or is it not?
It should be. It should be is the short answer on that.
Okay.
But no, to your first question, I have not seen the millions and millions of dollars. And if you think about the way that a case like this comes up, this is not. HHS is not out there auditing people's social media, you know, and we found there's 300 patient pictures on there. Right. So we're going to go back and look at your records and see if you've got 300 authorizations. The case comes up when a particular patient complains about it. And most often it's a particular patient is suing the practice anyway. And then a crafty lawyer says, oh, not only do I see a malpractice claim here, but I also see a HIPAA claim. And let's explore that a little further. So yeah, all of the cases I've seen have been where HHS is citing two, three, four specific instances, and then they're assessing a fine based on that.
Note to self, everybody out there, if a patient sues you, delete everything of theirs from social media immediately. And before we leave this topic, last question related to it, what about my team? My team is in all my social media photos. Do I need to have a release when I hire new employees that says this practice is a part of social media? If you're working here, you're consenting to being a part of our social media platform, or can you not make that a condition of employment?
No, you absolutely can make it a condition of employment. And the employees obviously don't have a HIPAA claim against you, but when we talk about photos of people that you're using for commercial purposes, which is a social media to promote your practice, it's commercial purposes. There's HIPAA, and there's two areas of the law that govern. There's HIPAA, and then there's just general name, image, and likeness law. Name, image, likeness law says that you can't use somebody's name, image, or likeness for commercial purposes without their authorization. Now, the law there is a lot squishier than HIPAA. It's not nearly as precise as HIPAA. You could potentially make an argument that the circumstances, you know, the staff knew that we were using these photos. They'd agreed to it 10 times in the past. They'd never objected. That kind of evidence could come to your defense in those cases, but I think it's just simpler. You know, you're giving them other paperwork to sign when they start employment. Just include a photo release from staff too, and then you've eliminated that potential argument by them. Again, if you terminate them later, disgruntled former employee is going to look for every possible reason to sue you. So just have them sign a name, image, and likeness release and take that out of the ammo box if they do try to sue you later.
Fair enough. So you come into my practice, your daughter just got finished with treatment, and she enters a drawing in my office to potentially win tickets to a Taylor Swift contest. And now I find out there's a possibility that I could be guilty of fee splitting, huh?
Well, on that one, potentially, I think the number one challenger would potentially be sweepstakes law.
I knew I was going to run afoul of some law. I thought it was going to be a maritime law of some sort, which right. Kind of pop. Like those maritime laws are really funny how they pop up in everyday life every now and then. But for those of you out there, we were talking beforehand, and this is one of those topics that Trey likes to talk about a little bit. Can you explain how the contests and the sweepstakes that we do in our offices can sometimes run afoul of sweepstakes law or run afoul of fee splitting laws?
Yeah, absolutely. So state sweepstakes laws are a little different in every state, but the general factors of whether you fall under sweepstakes law are basically the same in every state. So there's three things that have to be present. One is an element of chance. So that's your drawing. Any contest that that your office is doing any promotion that has a drawing in it. That's your element of chance. Second factor is that the patient has to give consideration to be entered. So consideration is a legal word for they have to do something of economic value to be entered into the contest. So certainly, you know, every new case start in the month of May gets entered into a drawing. There's economic value there because they're a case start. But courts have held that things like referrals, so you give, you know, a family or friend name as a referral, there's economic value to that. There's also economic value to positive reviews or, you know, five star. Every patient that gives us a five star rating gets entered. There's economic value to that also.
But there's no economic value to wearing rubber bands or brushing well or things like that.
Right? Coloring, you know, if you're, you know, like I've seen this in pedo, you know, pediatric dentist offices where every kid that colors a picture that they can put up on the wall gets entered into a drawing. There's no economic value for that color.
You've been entered into the drawing for the coloring you did, but not for the eight patients you referred. We just appreciate that.
Right.
I can read between the lines here, Trey.
Yeah, absolutely. No, you come from the family background of lawyers, so you've got some practice at this.
Who's asking?
Right. And then the third element that has to be present is a prize of value, which the dollar threshold depends on the state. It's usually pretty low. I mean, it's normally $40 or $50. It doesn't have to be thousands of dollars. So if you have all three of those factors present, you probably fall under state sweepstakes law in your state. The good thing is it's not incredibly burdensome to comply with the law. The biggest thing is there's going to typically a set of requirements for sweepstakes. The written terms and conditions is a big one. Having a defined start and an end date, a no purchase required for entry kind of an option where you send, you know, somebody can send in a postcard to be entered, those kind of things. But this is absolutely one of those, spend a few bucks and talk to a lawyer who's licensed in your state and can tell you all of that. There are a lot of law firms, the AAO, we even did this ourselves. Worked with a firm that has somebody specialized in sweepstakes law. They just create a template for you that every promotion you run after that, you literally just fill in the blanks, the start date, the end date, what's the prize, what's the requirement to enter, and then do the other things in there. And then you're in compliance with the law. But this is your question earlier about the violations and the per violation kind of calculation. This is one of those that can get you because a lot of times the penalty will be, let's say, like $300 per violation. A lot of states will say that if you've got a, you know, your Instagram page for your practice has 10,000 followers, you push something out, you've just committed 10,000 violations.
So this
is one of those where the math can add up. So definitely, if you're going to do those kind of things, just go for it. They're great promotions on social media. Just talk to a lawyer and get the template to make sure you're in compliance.
But now that you've said that, okay, there's law and then there's application of law. How many times in your career have you ever seen a dentist dinged for breaking sweepstakes law?
So I've not seen dental practices specifically that did, but I have seen other businesses get dinged for it. Now it's a lot, you know, some states they could care less. Some say it really, it's probably going to come down to the caseload, the workload of the attorney general's office. But I have seen other businesses in some states that have gotten dinged for that. So it's not a huge problem. I wouldn't stay awake at night worrying about this. And especially because, like I said, the compliance side of it is not prohibitively expensive. It's literally spend a couple of $100 with a lawyer that does this for a living, and you can get set up and be in compliance with the law pretty easily.
And I assume spinning a wheel falls under that as well. Like, you know, start braces in a month away, spin the wheel, right? Or something like that. It all games. But the fee splitting side of it, that's the part that interests me. How does that happen?
Yeah. So fee splitting. Okay. So I, you know, disclaimer here, not every state, some states you can only fee split with another doctor, another practitioner. Some states you can fee split with a patient. So that's, you know, if you're in a state where it's only fee splitting can only occur between two doctors, then you're off the hook here. But some states you can fee split with the patient. So if that is the case, then the analysis there with the what we talked about earlier is two factors for fee splitting. It's per patient or per referral, and then is there a prize, you know, some kind of compensation for it? But I think the drawing cases that can potentially get into fee splitting issue are the positive review situations or the referrals too. Those are the two those kind of promotions. Whether it's to be entered into a drawing or it's just, you know, the kind of promotions where every friend or family that you refer to us, you get a $25 Amazon gift card or it's that you get entered into your drawing for an iPad, something like that. All of those.
They really will enforce that. I mean, have you ever seen that actually? Again, I want to be crystal clear to everybody listening. When I ask, is it something you've ever seen? That is not meant, here's your legal, you know, my disclaimer. In no way, shape, or form am I minimizing the importance of the law and the books. I'm just curious more than anything to know the law is there, but have we ever seen anybody prosecuted for it?
So the challenge is, so it's going to be a dental board that would enforce that. Dental boards are the, you know, entity that have jurisdiction over fee splitting. So it's harder to monitor those because so many dental board proceedings are confidential unless there's a decision against the licensee that's rendered it. And that makes it really hard to track those cases. Because here's the thing, even if ultimately you go through the dental board proceeding and they determine that you're not in violation of the law, nobody wants that headache of being. So I will say I'm not aware of any case where a dental board has proactively gone out and found a situation like that and then asserted a complaint against somebody. But what I have seen a couple of instances, even in my 5 years at the AO, is where one competitor in a town gets wind that somebody is doing that kind of a promotion and then turns them into the dental board. And a dental board will look at the situation in those circumstances.
Ain't peers grand.
Yeah.
And as one of my friends once told me, and knock on wood, I've never been in front of a dental board in my 30 plus years and being in practice. His exact words, you do not ever want to stand in front of a dental board if you can avoid it, because you just don't know what they're going to be like. And it's unfortunate, but many of them are punitive for no good reason. Before we let you go, I want to invoke a little George Carlin-esque moment. You remember George Carlin had his list of dirty words?
Yes.
Anybody out there who's never listened to George Carlin and his dirty words, it's worth listening to. Disclaimer, because I have the AAO General Counsel, I am not guilty of any of the violations of anything he's speaking about nowadays, if you listen to George Carlin. But he had his dirty words, and you've got your 8 words that you should never use in advertising, right?
Yes. For dental.
So, yeah, dental words. They're not four-letter words.
No.
You shouldn't use an advertising. I just want to
probably
say that.
But that's a different analysis. That's,
Dr.
That's
Krieger not... is the best orthodontist in Texas. Right. But what are the 8 words that one should not use in advertising if they're an orthodontist?
Yeah. So 8 things. We'll add a couple of words to it. 8 things you shouldn't say in dental advertising. Number one, anything that's not supported by hard factual evidence. Dental boards, many states have a specific rule that pertains to this. And Texas is the set of rules I always use because they have the most thorough set of regulations for dental advertising. But anything that is not supported by hard factual evidence, which leads to number 2 and number 3, which is comparative claims about doctors or your doctors or your practice, and comparative claims about treatment methods, materials, and supplies. Because anytime you talk about better than, best, I'm the best whatever in town, our treatment is the best whatever in town.
We're the fastest orthodontists, right? You could go do an audit of all your patients and see how long you treat and compare to others. But realistically, anything that claims you are better, faster, more thorough, you know, whatever, than any other orthodontist would be technically something to stay away from.
Yeah, it would be very hard to come up with the hard factual evidence to support that. Now, you could say I'm the leading provider of, you know, a certain brand of aligner or something like that. And you may have factual, you know, you may get statistics from the company that supports that, or, you know, that certainly the top 1%, those kind of comparative claims. But short of that, I would stay away from them.
Okay.
Besides that, don't create unjustified expectations. That's what many states have a dental board rule on. I would say patient testimonials are a big challenge there. If you're using patient testimonials in your advertising, then you're responsible for what's said there, even though you're not actually saying it. So is what this patient saying about, you know, the treatment they received, is something I can reasonably guarantee to other patients? Certainly I used to be embarrassed to smile. I went and treated with Dr. Krieger. Now that I'm confident I can smile in pictures. That's pretty typical of what a lot of orthodontist patients say. You know, I think that's fair game. But if you start getting into this has impacted my life because I'm, you know, more attracted to the opposite sex, or
now I got married, you know, I found a wife or husband because of my new smile.
Right. That may be creating unjustified expectations. You probably can't promise that you can deliver that for other patients. So don't create unjustified expectations. Painless or pain-free dentistry. I don't see this as much with orthodontic practices, although I have seen a couple of Instagram names that imply, you know, the gentle or something that's starting to get in that territory. But as weird and obscure as it seems, many dental boards have rules say you can't advertise pain-free or painless dentistry. I think a lot of times practices think they're going to be cute, do things through patient testimonials that they can't say directly themselves. Don't do that. View anything that you're using that a patient said with the same lens and the same rules that you use for your own statements. And then finally, advertising as a specialist in orthodontics. I mentioned this one to, you know, on an orthodontic forum, because good news for orthodontists, the rule in nearly every state is you have to have graduated from a residency program and a CODA recognized specialty to advertise as an orthodontic specialist. So everybody who's graduated from an orthodontic residency program can do that. The reason I always mention this and include this is because, you know, a GP can advertise that they're doing orthodontic treatment. They cannot advertise that they're an orthodontist or imply that they're a specialist in orthodontics. And if AAO members see somebody that's advertising like that, a dentist that's advertising as an orthodontic specialist, let the AAO know. I mean, we're the AAO. We're not a governmental agency. We can't force anybody to do anything, but we will send them a letter. Just make sure they're aware of the dental specialty advertising laws and their state. And what we found is, you know, 99 times out of 100, it's just lack of awareness of what the laws are about the advertising or the name of their practice.
So it raises an interesting point, because is it the word orthodontic specialist? Can you say we specialize in orthodontics or anything that relates to specialty and orthodontics you cannot put together if you're not a specialist?
Correct. Yeah.
It's interesting, because there's an orthodontic office near me. It's very rare. It's a foreign dentist who came to the United States and never got specialty training in the United States. So by definition, they are a dentist, but they're not an orthodontist, right? That's the state law. But they hold themselves out as an orthodontist and have an orthodontic office. Doesn't say orthodontic specialist, but they are an orthodontist and dental facial orthopedist. So it's like they're skirting the rules, and I never say a word. I don't care one way or the other at the end of the day if you want to deceive the public. But I've had numerous patients come to me and go, oh, she's an orthodontist or he's an orthodontist. I go, you know, look a little more carefully. I mean, because they're coming to me now and they're unhappy, what have you. So it's really interesting how people learn to skirt the law in a pretty interesting way, to say the very least. Thank you for all your time. I mean, again, as Judge Wapner used to say, don't take the law into your own hands, take them to court. But we hope they don't do that with us.
Yeah. No, we want to keep people out of court. Nobody, I mean, from 18 years of being a litigator, nobody wants to be in court. The best litigation strategy is stay out of court in the first place.
I just want to add one little piece of advice to that. Again, once you hit a certain age and you have a few gray hairs in your beard, you learn a few lessons. What you just said, in my opinion, is arguably the most important piece of information you've given the whole day. And the reason I say that is because there are going to be times in every person's career, and if you practice long enough, you know what I'm referring to, where you are right. You are 100% correct in what you did. You did nothing wrong. And yet, on the other side of that phone or that letter or that email or Facebook message is an unreasonable human being asking for something. They haven't gone to court, but they're going to say to you, I want my money back for this, or I don't want to pay for that. And you're going to get upset and you're going to get angry and you're going to let emotion take over. And listen to what Trey just said. General counsel for the AAO, Trey Lawrence, said the best advice he can give you is just to stay out of court. So my question to each and every one of you out there is, when that patient says, I'm unhappy, I want my money back, and you go, but I treated them for 3 years, is the peace of mind of refunding one case worth it to you to stay out of court? Would you disagree?
Could not agree more with what you just said. No, I had many clients over the year, my pre-AAO days, that wanted to take a stand on principle. And they told us at the beginning of the case, I don't care how much I spend on this. I just want a judge to say that I'm right. And so thankfully, most of the time we did not believe them, and we coached them off of that. The few times where somebody said that and we moved through with that strategy, none of those clients were ever happy at the end.
No.
Because even if they got the judgment, because of how much time and money they spent to get there. So no, stay out of court. Absolutely.
Like Elsa from Frozen, let it go. Okay. And again, I've said this story numerous times. I was a young dentist, probably out of school 4 or 5 years. And I had a patient call and I did this spectacular, I still remember this gorgeous single occlusal filling. You're talking about a $150 filling, like it's nothing. And she called me and complained. And she was just one of those who wanted her money back for no good reason. I want my money back. And I called my attorney because at least I knew, don't deal with this patient directly. She's irrational. Have my attorney deal with her. And he said, Glenn, you can refund the $150 or you can pay me for 3 or 4 hours of my time, which will cost you probably close to $1,000 at the time. And what have you gained? Give her back her $150. Never worry. You're not going to lose any sleep over the cases you've done. You'll never lose sleep over the case you refund the money for, unless you just can't let it go. In which case, see a therapist and spend your money there instead. And so thank you, Trey, for everything you do on behalf of all of us. And for those who are not AAO members, even on behalf of those who are not members, because it trickles down. And again, there's some great takeaways here that don't apply just to orthodontics, but apply to dentistry as well. So if you're an ortho listening to this and you think it could help one of your dental friends, please share it with them. Let them listen to it and hear it. And you can find Trey on Instagram at orthattorney, like orthodontics, orthattorney. There's no O in the middle, just at the beginning. The orthattorney, like the Missouri State.
Absolutely.
So the orthattorney on Instagram. And of course, if they want to reach out to you, how do they get a hold of you if they're an AAO member and would love to ask a question of not just general counsel, but a question of the AAO legal team?
Yeah, the easiest way is going to be go on the AAO member website, find the legal resources tab, and you will find, and I apologize, I don't remember, it's relatively new. I don't remember the specific title, the link, but it will be very obvious, the question submission form under the legal resources tab on the AAO member website.
Fantastic. Can't thank you enough for everything you're doing to help us. And thanks again for being here today, Trey.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you.